Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Buongiorno! You're listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, Lady P, no relation to Master P. Joining me today is Eurosophisticate and FlixWise co-producer, Mr. Martin Kessler. Say hi, Martin.
Ciao. Hey. Hello.
Also with us today is the founder and editor of Sales on Film, and she's an American, so naturally she talks really loud. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Miss Kristen Sales.
Yes, it's yeah. True.
Hi. Yeah, I that's what I love about Fellini movies. Americans are always extra loud. Anyway, Kristen, I have a very serious question for you. What flavor profile best describes your existential state?
Flavor profile?
Yes.
Vanilla?
I can't tell you how many times I've been asked that. Vanilla? Oh, okay.
I don't understand the question.
Vanilla
so I'm
works.
Just, I'm just going with
you
vanilla.
You can do whatever. There's no wrong answer here. I was going to say bitter. But, you know, or salty. But this is a family show. So, well, here's your chance for a taste of the sweet life, because today's Sight and Sound entry is the 39th greatest movie of all time, Federico Fellini's 1960 feature film, La Dolce Vita. And once we're done living it up in Italy, we're going to really indulge ourselves with a general discussion about our favorite depictions of on-screen extravagance. Then we'll cleanse our palates with a few final notes of positivity. All right, you ready to dig in?
Ready.
Ready, Freddy.
First up, we have Federico Fellini's La Dolce Vita. The film stars Marcello Mastroianni as a tabloid reporter named Marcello. Go figure. La Dolce Vita is about Marcello gallivanting around Rome, chasing after the latest in society and celebrity tale. I mean gossip. Gossip. When Marcello isn't on the hunt for a story, he can usually be found in the arms of a beautiful woman or playing wingman to his photographer pal, Paparazzo. Occasionally, he'll stop in on some glamorous party thrown by the fading remnants of the Italian aristocracy. The man's got every corner of the city covered. There's one corner in Rome where you are sure not to find Marcello, and that is whichever corner his long-suffering fiancé happens to be occupying. The poor thing adores Marcello in spite of his constant philandering and neglect. Marcello's inability to connect and fully commit to his fiancé is indicative of the way he regards most of his life's pursuits. All is to be tasted and enjoyed for short periods of time, but nothing is to be fully ingested. A shallow worldview, to be sure, but when all the glitz and glamour of the high life wears thin, Marcello visits his intellectual friend Steiner. Steiner's an even-keeled family man, always ready to lend Marcello an ear or offer an inspiring pep talk. He assures Marcello that it's not too late to pursue a more fulfilling, meaningful life. So it probably doesn't bode well that towards the end of the film, Steiner goes on a murderous rampage, killing both himself and his two children. The story unfolds in chapters, with each chapter finding Marcello digging deeper into the world of frivolity and debauchery. La Dolce Vita was a departure for Fellini. Prior to this film, Fellini's pictures kept in step with the neorealist trends of the 1940s and 50s. Instead of spotlighting the miserable outlook of society's meek and downtrodden, the focus now was on the opulent, but no less bleak, lifestyles of the rich and famous. This film, along with other Sight and Sound entries, such as Michelangelo Antonioni's La Ventura and Luchino Visconti's The Leopard, paved the way for a new modernist era in Italian filmmaking. But is La Dolce Vita's cry of existential despair still as fashionable these days as it was some 55 years ago? We shall discuss. Kristen.
Yes.
Do you like La Dolce Vita?
I think I like it with reservations.
Okay.
I appreciate the filmmaking. It's kind of hard not to. Mm-hmm. Fellini is Fellini, mm-hmm. and he's a master. I think one's relationship to La Dolce Vita shifts quite a bit depending on where in your life you are when you watch it. Mm-hmm. And I saw it first when I was in college. It was about, I guess, 8 years ago, and I was going through a Fellini phase, and I was going through a Criterion phase, and I was pretty just susceptible and receptive to watching and appreciating the films that are canonically acknowledged to be the greatest. Mm-hmm. So I was like, kind of, I was blown away because my familiarity with filmmaking on the scale, the ambition of it, the scope of it was impressive to me. I think rewatching it now, it's less impressive in that way, but still relevant to me as I get older. And I feel like if I watch this every 10 years or so, I will have a different relationship to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Martin, how do you feel about La Dolce Vita?
Well, I don't really like it much.
Whoa! Wow!
I'm sorry.
Oh, crap. Okay,
like, I still think it's interesting and worth discussing, so I'm here. But I never really had a Fellini phase yet. Like, I've seen a few of his movies, Casanova, Roma, Satyricon, 8.5. But, like, I haven't really connected with any of them yet.
Wow, okay.
And I think the thing I kind of have the hardest time with in this film is that there's not a lot of connective tissue between the scenes, and that doesn't necessarily bother me in and of itself, but like, mm-hmm. after 3 hours this movie really wore me down. Like, this movie I had a hard time keeping up with it.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, I, like Kristen, I also had a Fellini phase probably around 18 years old, I'm gonna say. And I don't, like, he's so, there's nothing quite like a Fellini film. He's just, you know a Fellini movie. You know when you're watching a Fellini movie. And I have to say, when I first saw this movie, I wasn't that taken with it. But having rewatched it now, I think I liked it more than you guys did. I don't know. Like, there's something so time capsule-y about it that I kind of like it for that very reason. Like, it's a real exaggeration of what was happening at the time. It's the world filtered through Fellini's lens, but I think it pretty much sums it up. But yeah,
it sums it up sort of too much. I think that I should say that I think I am more on the side of liking it.
Okay, good.
If
okay.
I was Rotten Tomatoes, okay, it would be fresh.
Okay.
But it's not like, I'm not super in love with it. I think my problem this time, which I managed to completely not get when I was 19 or whatever, is that it's very, very sort of wants to teach you a lesson. It's very much about the things that it's about, in a way that struck me as being very obvious.
Okay.
Distractingly obvious.
Okay.
Well, I was sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was wondering a little bit while watching it, like, it is kind of a moralizing film. Like, it even ends with looking right into camera. Like, it's like, what about you, audience? But, mm-hmm. like, I think Fellini might have been indulging more in the amorality or immorality of the film than really being interested in the moralizing aspects of it.
Yeah. I assume that Marcello is Fellini's proxy. It feels more autobiographical than, you know, take your medicine kind of thing. Like, I didn't think he was shaming the audience. I didn't get that impression.
I don't think it is moralizing as if to say learn a lesson.
Yeah.
I just think that the way that the big themes and symbols are handled as a filmmaking, it's kind of clumsy.
Okay.
I think overall the takeaway, or what Fellini is quote unquote saying, is how Marcello acts. That sort of passive, take it as it comes attitude, just sort of floating through everything as if to say, well, look at this, and these are the people I'm interacting with, but not getting attached to anything. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the overriding message, in that there is no message.
Yeah, but it's interesting how the views on cultural writing and journalism have changed. Like, it is no longer a passive activity. Like, we are actively engaging with our art in a way. I guess that it isn't. We don't actually see any of Marcello's art or what he has to say, which I think is actually, that would have been interesting.
Well, I think the critique is that we don't see it.
Mm.
And the one time where he does go away to the seaside to try to write, he can.
Mm-hmm.
So there is this like implicit impotence in terms of, is he an artist? If he creates anything, is it going to be any good? Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the Steiner's character comes in, because he's a guy that presumably has created things and surrounds himself with people who do create art.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's this sort of question mark around Marcello, is that, is he a writer? Was he ever a writer? And if he was it worthwhile?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Yeah. But as I said, this is a very common theme. Right around 1960, you have both this film and La Ventura coming out that same year, where Pauline Kael later dubbed it "Come Dressed as the Sick Soul of Europe."
Yeah, she lumped in Last Year at Marienbad,
right?
So with that as well.
Yeah, exactly.
To quite a dim view of these sort of rich people problems, which is what we would call them now.
Yeah. I think that just perfectly.
Actually, wait a second, because I did read some of this essay. It wasn't La Ventura that she had a mm-hmm. problem with; it was Linotti.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
She loved La Ventura,
yes.
Which is an interesting, I don't know, as a sidebar, that's an interesting designation, because most people do not separate those, that mm-hmm. unofficial trilogy. Most people don't separate them.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
No, I think that speaks to Pauline Kael.
Yeah, just Kael things, yeah. basically. Yeah.
As soon as other people started liking it, it was no longer okay, acceptable to like it.
Right, a little bit.
She's pretty shameless. yeah, I don't know. Like, I think we kind of want to cover this in the second topic more than the first, but my tolerance for this subject, where it's wealthy people feeling angsty, in beautiful locales, like, I don't know if that speaks to me now as much as it would have when I was younger. But that being said, I found myself very frustrated by this when I watched it when I was 18, and I think I understand Marcello more now than I did.
You were frustrated by the fact that these rich people were just sort of squandering their wealth?
I don't know. It was just like, I found everything about it obnoxious and tedious. And I can't recall exactly what it was about the movie. Maybe it was like, there just weren't enough funny faces. I was not a very sophisticated movie watcher, I think. I don't know.
The Marcello character is very frustrating, because he comes across as very cool, very jaded. But then mm-hmm. you start realizing how like lonely he is, how much self-loathing there is. And when he starts lashing out more and more towards the end, you kind of get a sense that... I don't mean to jump to the ending right away, but at the beginning, it's like he's talking and not being understood, but at the end he's not the one understanding and he's not the one listening, and you sort of realize that it's the fact that he's a passive character doesn't make him any less responsible for his own problems or his own angst.
I think you hit it on the head, Martin, in terms of that final scene where it's communicated to the audience that his inability to connect with his fellow human beings, as you know, literalized in that final scene, is because of his own passiveness. So he's mm-hmm. you know, shrugging off what could be the only human connection he seems to have been able to make throughout the course of the movie, and then just kind of that's the end. I mean, because that's the kind of person that he is, and the kind of you know, micro cultural bubble that he is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Martin and I talked about Bicycle Thieves earlier this year, and I believe we mentioned this movie, or at least movies like it, where it's such a stark contrast, because Bicycle Thieves was 48, this is 1960. And during that time, obviously, we had the implementation of the Marshall Plan, and this is post or during the Italian economic miracle. And so it's fascinating to see how much Italy has changed during that time. And that goes back to the whole time capsule thing that I was talking about. And that that alone for me is reason enough to appreciate the movie. And although I will say, like, Visconti is good at showing off wealth, Fellini's really good at making it look disgusting.
There's always an element of the grotesque, which I think comes back to his fascination with circuses. Mm-hmm. And to him, really any group of people has the potential to be a circus with that sort of childlike wonder and fascination, but there's also a grotesquerie to it.
Mm-hmm. And even a lot of the beautiful images, like there are some very pretty images in this film, they're also kind of repulsive because they're beautiful almost in the way that like a car commercial is beautiful. Like it's such a hollow experience that it's sort of off-putting, I think.
Because it's about people who only live surface lives, and surfaces are what is important to them.
Let's talk about the rich people in the movie. There's the famous people and there's the rich people, and then there are the really rich people, or the people who used to be really rich and are now living in crumbling old mansions. Do you think that Fellini has affection for the aristocratic figures in the film, or is it... It seems like he does. He has some sympathy and fondness for them because they're extravagant. They're over the top, but again, you have that typical Fellini. He's obviously making fun of them at the same time. So I don't know. What was your reaction?
Affection? I don't know.
No,
I don't. I'm not sure if he has affection for the people in the film. I think he has affection as a visual stylist for the way that they look and the way that their environs look, and that's captured in the film. But then again, I don't think this is like a Buñuel situation where he's entirely sort of gutting them via satire. So I think it's somewhere in the middle, which is kind of what this whole movie is.
Yeah.
It's somewhere in the middle in terms of look at these things, but I'm not going to go all the way either right or left on what these people are about.
I mean, I think that's good though, right? I think that's more interesting, or maybe it's not, to go to you make your own call.
I don't think it's good or bad, but I think that's maybe why all of us are somewhere in between with this movie, because it is non-committal, which I think in terms of filmmaking is the more interesting choice, because I think a film that preaches at you relentlessly is boring. But I also think a film that is like out to get you, a gotcha film, something like a very, very didactic documentary, quote unquote, like a Michael Moore movie or something,
right.
is a dull as well.
Because
you know when you buy a ticket to the movie what the filmmaker has in mind, and you can sort of see the steps, you know, from one act to the next. And this is 3 hours long. You have to sort of watch through all of it. It's episodic. And so even if you like one tableau, it goes to the next one and you have to adjust. So I think in terms of reception, there is a lot more going on than if he had said this is this way or this is that way.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, when I watch the film, like, I think that the scenes with the old guard are the most interesting. And I think Fellini thinks they're fascinating, just as specimens. But as you said, as a visual stylist, maybe that's where that's coming from. Maybe they're just the most interesting to look at.
I feel sort of a kinship between these princesses and the old grandma princess, visually how they're represented with, but also like with whores. It's like I feel like Fellini doesn't really have. His fascination with types of people are not limited to their social class. If anything is maybe different from him, or different from the majority of people, whether it's, you know, one to end or the other, that's what he's going to focus in on. So if it's a very old woman wearing ridiculous feathers and walking around a castle, or if it's a, you know, in 8 1/2, if it's a very large, semi-grotesque prostitute living on the beach, it's like these are interesting things to look at, and these are interesting lives to examine, and that's kind of the vibe I get in this film.
Totally. But also Fellini's aesthetic is very baroque, which signifies an older style, or is an older style of, is an older aesthetic, and that sort of clashes with the new modern aesthetic. So maybe that's, again, that feels like maybe I'm just projecting, but I feel like Fellini might relate more to this older generation than with the kids in their rock and roll.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's sort of an element of voyeurism to it, but it's interesting that you say that it's like a Baroque style, because I think it's the scene where they're playing Bach in the church. It sort of made me think mm-hmm. of Baroque music and then Baroque architecture, how opulent and detailed it is. And this is such a opulent film. I think he is sort of drawn to the past. He's interested in the past, like these people against the old parts of the city. It sort of made me think of Romans from the days of Nero's court, and connecting, all the way through Italy's history, thinking how the modern Rome fits into that through his film, how it's kind of built on top of this complex history. And there's a lot of I think little allusions to ghosts, which I thought was kind of interesting. There's the whole sequence where they go looking for a ghost, but it's sort of metaphorical way, I guess, like Marcello is sort of a ghost floating through this world.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a film that is very interested in the past and how it infers or how it informs the present.
Right. Yeah.
Or do you think 1960 in that case.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is Marcello a man of his time, or do you think the reason that he's unable to connect with people is because he is a man of the past? Or, I mean, what do you think is the source of his malaise? Ugh. I hate that word, sorry. Do we get any indication, or is it just like he's a wealthy dude in Italy? Of course he's, feckless.
Well, I think it's probably his own mediocrity. They sort of, even though you don't really get to hear it, it's sort of inferred that he's a mediocre writer and somebody who's smart enough to realize that he's not capable of accomplishing what he wants, and he's sort of trapped by that. And I think, like, in a certain way, Steiner represents a lot of his fears of settling down and then being swallowed up by this sort of existential terror. I think what kind of perpetuates the negative aspects of Marcello's character is that he's afraid of settling down. He's always trying to keep moving, but that's turned him into this ghostly character, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We should probably talk about the women in the movie. Fellini, not always kind to actresses. If anything, that's what leaves the worst taste in my mouth, usually.
The women.
Unless it's a movie starring Giulietta Messina, like, it's usually the women are so sidelined or just pathetic. Most of the people in the film are pathetic, but the women in particular.
Well, the women are there to reflect off of Marcello.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what you take away from is that they represent or mirror or present his own faults. So yes, they are archetypal because they are objects for him to react to and to come to realizations about. And the structure of the film itself is episodic. So it's you're getting these sort of characters just in little bits, and they are all sort of symbolic and representational because that's the type of filmmaking. I think the difference between the movies that are about quote-unquote Fellini's women, which is a topic that it seems like film writers are never-ending source of fascination for them, but the difference between those and the films where Giulietta Messina is the lead is that she is the lead.
Mm-hmm.
The films are structured around her and her ability and her performance ability, and that's where they come from. Mm-hmm. So it's the nature of what type of movie it is. And when Marcello Mastroianni is the lead, it's Fellini saying, this is more or less me,
mm-hmm.
and these are my fears and anxieties, and my fears and anxieties are represented by different types of women.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think for Marcello, the character in this movie, his dalliances, his interaction with these women, represent his sort of attempts to find humanity, to make connections with people. And every time he fails represents a different motivation behind his failure.
It almost seems like it's the women reaching out to him and he's the one rejecting them or lashing back out against them. Like, the story sort of made me think of Dante's Purgatory, and I was sort of thinking how maybe one of these women characters could be like Beatrice and lead him out of Marcello's Purgatory, but instead he's sort of descending downwards to his own personal hell, not towards paradise.
Yeah. How many... I have not read The Inferno, I must confess. But I wonder if the number of chapters corresponds to the number La Dolce Vita.
I didn't think to check.
Something
but,
to think about.
That is a
theory. I wouldn't
be
surprised because there's enough stuff going on in this movie. It could be... I don't think Fellini was especially religious, but I think Catholicism definitely informs this movie in a way that I think it's probably impossible not to, being in Italy at that time. He kind of ridicules it, but, you know, the giant flying Jesus with Marcello, it's like the second coming or something. Mm-hmm. The whole part with the Virgin Mary after, it's kind of like a big joke, but I think it's sort of saying that this is a world without values, Catholic values, or I guess any kind of values, and Marcello's sort of a person in search of a soul.
Right, yeah. Maybe. So the flying... No, I think that makes a lot of sense. The flying Jesus at the beginning is getting out of Dodge, or...
I think he's arriving, like, okay. Marcello has arrived, Jesus has come, and like... By the end, that the stingray they kind of drag up, it's the opposite. Like, they just, instead of this thing descending from the sky, it's drug up from the depths and it's dying, and it looks to them hideous. And I think Marcello, when he like looks into the eye, he's just seeing maybe a reflection of himself in this stingray. Mm-hmm. And like the I don't know, I'm being overly reading to it.
No, that's why Fellini put all this in here.
Yeah. The opening's a little ambiguous. Like, is Jesus coming or going? If he's coming, is he watching over everyone, or is Jesus gone and this is what's left? I don't know. I wasn't sure.
I don't know. I think it's more that image opens the film so that you can immediately get to this juxtaposition of sacred and profane, and it immediately tells you that the situation, more or less, in post-war Italy at the time.
Yeah.
It's like, people are still very religious, and they're beautiful women in bikinis, right, bathing.
Right.
And that's more or less, it's like Jesus is Marcello's wingman. Like, he uses the Jesus to try to get these girls' numbers. So you're really, like, it's probably the most demonstrative opening scene that you could have in this film of all the other scenes that follow after it.
Right.
Because it immediately conveys some of the most important sort of elements that Fellini wants to set up.
Yeah, yeah. It does. It plays like a joke. Like,
we're at this, yeah, like, it's
big
a joke
opening.
It's certainly a joke.
Jesus.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really funny. I don't know. It works.
But I think it's interesting too that it opens too with that joke, but then you get the rather sort of serious sequence in the middle of the children seeing the Madonna, and even though that's a circus and there's a lot of humor in that sequence, it does end with a man losing his life. So it's, you know, there are different tonal shifts in terms of even these subjects that I think Fellini feels comfortable joking about.
Mm-hmm. Is that part of your mixed reaction? I know you like the movie, but is it tonal shifts? Is it just hard to adjust, does it not jive well?
No, I neither of those.
Okay.
I just think that it's, to me, it my problem stems from more of the symbolic obviousness.
Okay, yeah.
So it's, yeah. No, it's, I think, like, speaking about that Madonna scene in specific, it's like, you know that the way that the scene is constructed, it's too absurd for something tragic not to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So you can kind of see those seams, because there needs to be a point at the end of the sequence.
Right, yeah.
That tonal shift, though, like, I think the movie keeps kind of hitting the same beat over and over again. It's like party hangover, party hangover, and it kind of follows that little high and then low structure just over and over and over again the whole way through. I mean, it's the same sort of emotional arc, just repeated constantly. And I sort of wonder if maybe all the segments or all the episodes are totally necessary to tell this story.
Which do you think are especially superfluous?
Well, I'm not sure any of them are isolated on their own, but together it feels kind of like overkill.
Okay.
If we're getting
something
so different out of the episode where Marcello's father comes to visit, that's so unique that we're not getting that elsewhere in the film, or I don't know, what do you think?
I agree with that. I just think that, and I think that contributes to the sort of exhaustion that you might feel after watching the film, because it is the repetition and the the revelry and the hangover structure of it is, of course, the point. That's why Marcello's, you know, worn out at the end. But it does put watching the film does put you through the ringer. So it is one of those films that where you feel like the main character. I understand that point of view, and I think that's one of the reasons that people either have a negative reaction or a mixed reaction, because that type of storytelling, I think that's a fine line to walk. You really have to, you need to sort of combine subtlety with the obviousness of what you're trying to convey. Right. For me, I think because of Fellini's visual style is so engaging constantly, and I think Marcello Mastroianni's performance is always very good. Those elements keep me on the, you know, positive side of this movie.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think we would be remiss if we didn't mention the Trevi Fountain sequence.
Marcello, come here!
It's preposterously glamorous. It's great beauties and come get wet. Like, it's I think it's almost on par with something like the Marilyn Monroe under the air vent or something like that. It's I think that's probably the reason why it sticks out in people's minds. I think too, like, I don't mean to sound overly cynical, but I think because it comes earlier in the film, it's also maybe sticks out in people's minds because it's there before maybe some people check out.
I agree with that. I think it comes at a very a point in the film where it hasn't really gotten too dark yet. You're still sort of very comfortably within the realm of satire and media satire, which everyone is down for. Nobody's like, I don't want to see another media satire like everyone does.
Yeah.
and the Marilyn Monroe thing is 100% self-referential. That whole scene where it's the press day or whatever, there's so many in-jokes about American movie stars and American culture in general. And she even says, her character even says, I must tell Marilyn about this. So she herself is supposed to be a Marilyn Monroe type, but then also it's implied in the world of the film that she is like friends with Marilyn. So there is a definite self-referential thing going on that would be funny to audiences at the time, but is also very relevant now.
You know. I love that. That's so funny.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's sort of hard because that scene, that press day or whatever, goes by very quickly and you're reading the subtitles, but and it's in Italian and English, that scene, so it's kind of hard to catch, but there are a lot of in-jokes that are really funny.
Yeah.
Like one of the journalists asks Anita Ekberg, what do you think? Is neorealism alive or dead? And her press agent whispers to her and says, say alive. she doesn't answer the question. But I mean, that's an example of the kind of, Fellini knows what he's doing.
Right, right.
And I think that's one of the reasons why that sequence with Anita Ekberg is so appealing to people. Also, there's like a 20-minute dance scene, which is just fun to watch.
Yeah.
It goes on too long, arguably, but it is, at least you're like looking at dynamic, you know, people.
Yeah. That's really funny. There's something, it's so self-conscious in a way that could get very tiresome.
And I think if the whole movie was pitched at the same level of that sequence, it would be.
Yeah. And, but in a way, it is. It is very, I mean, it's very self-aware. It seems like you can hear Fellini giggling behind the camera throughout most of it.
Sometimes. Yeah. Sometimes it's self-aware. Sometimes it's self-serious.
Yeah.
And it does sort of live between those two poles.
Mm-hmm. But I feel like I should stick up for this movie a little bit more, because I don't disagree with anything either of you are saying, but just because this movie and movies like it informed the way that I so much about the way that I thought about making movies. So I do want to give it credit for that. There's something very juvenile about it, and that it is very self-conscious. Like, everyone, when you're young, you think everyone is fascinated by your thoughts. The truth is, most people, I certainly hope, don't care.
Unless they're listening to this podcast.
Right, of course.
They should be very interested in what we have to say.
Yes. but, I mean, obviously, our thoughts on film are super fascinating, but our thoughts on the state of existence, perhaps less so.
But aren't those one and the same, Lady P?
Is there anything else? You're so right. I mean, you can see Fellini obviously in Woody Allen. I mean, it's like,
any movie in which it's more or less about the writer director, or about a writer who is moonlighting in another profession, but he really wants to be a writer.
Right.
I mean, God, that's the same story. And because movies are written by writers,
yes,
you end up having a lot of movies like that.
Yeah, funny how that works.
And there were plenty of films that influence La Dolce Vita. I mean, this isn't the first film to like focus on the travails of, you know, the idle classes.
Yes.
There's a lot of specifically European cinema that feeds into this.
Mm-hmm.
This is just like Italy's turn to do what, let's face it, the French have been doing since the beginning of time. And so being about Italy,
mm-hmm.
I feel like that's why Fellini is put so much, you know, capital letters, this is about Italy,
mm-hmm.
things in it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of national character and a lot of striving to put in things that are about a national character,
mm-hmm.
whereas the French don't really worry about that so mm-hmm. much.
All right, well, I feel like I didn't do a very good job sticking up for it. That was bad on my part. My affection for it is rooted in nostalgia, kind of, because I used to love not just this film, because obviously I had kind of mixed feelings about this film when I first saw it, but just Fellini films in general, and they're all pitched at this same level.
Well, I don't know. I don't agree with that.
Really?
Yeah. I think this is sort of mid-tier in terms of what...
Okay. Well, obviously, the I'm thinking La Strada and Knights of Cabiria are very, very different films. And
yeah, they're cheap. Different, but even, like I mean, Fellini in the 70s
mm-hmm.
is way different.
Yeah.
It's much less concerned with structure. It's much less concerned with even story,
mm-hmm.
you know, something like yeah. Roma, something like Roma.
No, story.
No, not at all. It's just like, look at these beautiful images. And so I think that, and even something like 8.5, which is more or less a very similar movie to La Dolce Vita. I think people prefer that movie because it's not as self-serious.
Mm-hmm.
There is a dreamlike quality. You're kind of having a good time.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's almost every subsequent Fellini movie sort of goes towards more in that direction,
okay.
more in the sort of like, this is a movie about sensations and it's sensuous. And I think maybe people prefer that. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I could see that. And yet, this is the 39th movie on the Sight and Sound list. How do you like that for a transition? I'm good. Good job. Anyway, my referencing it less good. But I'm guessing 39, maybe too high, perhaps? Martin, what do you think?
Honestly, like, this film is a part of pop culture. It's even where we get the word paparazzi from.
It is.
It's influential in films. I think, like, I can, even though I personally don't really like this film,
okay.
I'm totally open to maybe coming back to this film and having it maybe mean something different to me at a different stage in my life. Like, mm-hmm. I think it's just...
Right. I think it is one of those films. It's any kind of young person movie means something different when you watch it later. Like, Catcher in the Rye is a totally different reading experience when you watch it as a teenager versus a 20-year-old versus a 30-year-old. Any depiction of formative years, I think, takes on a very different quality. And I guess even any first-person narrative, I think your reaction to it will change when you get, as you age.
Yeah, because so much of this movie hinges on you relating to Marcello.
Right.
And depends on where you are in your life.
Right.
But that's why I think it remains a relevant film, and just by virtue of how it's structured, mm-hmm. it's that kind of narrative is, you will always revisit it, or it has the potential to change as you change.
Mm-hmm. Right. So perhaps one day we'll be outraged that it's not higher. Maybe. Yeah. But I can imagine being a film goer in the 1960s and seeing this movie and just having my mind totally blown.
That's why it's on. Why it's so high on the list.
Yeah.
Because culturally, this movie blew the doors open, especially for American audiences. And it coincided and helped to re-establish interest in Americans abroad going to Italy.
Mm-hmm.
I think I read that this movie actually, was in the top 10 for American box office.
Wow.
In 1960, which is extraordinary.
Yeah.
But also it coincided with, La Ventura, which was also sort of a cultural, mostly among intellectuals. Mm-hmm. They were like, you got to go see this mm-hmm. this crazy movie, La Ventura. You'll never know what it's about.
Yeah.
Still
trying to figure it out.
But whenever I think about even Mad Men, Mad Men had that season where Don and Betty go to Italy. That's them going because they watched mm-hmm. La Dolce Vita, mm-hmm. more or less. I mm-hmm. mean, it's that kind of thing. It did become a huge thing for the emergent American middle class.
Exactly.
There's really no sort of denying how culturally important it is.
Hear, hear. Okay. All right, hold on, you jet setters. Keep that private plane grounded and tell driver to circle the block. We've still got a whole other topic to discuss. Our next segment is going to cover different examples of cinematic opulence. La Dolce Vita is certainly one of the most famous examples of extravagant living that has ever graced the big screen, but there are certainly plenty more to choose from. We're going to figure out what exactly is the appeal of watching the filthy rich be filthy and rich. And then we're going to talk about some of our personal favorite depictions of the moneyed elite. So let's keep the champagne flowing and get into it. So maybe we can do just like a breakdown of the kinds of ways that over-the-top wealth is depicted on screen. Because it's not always just, look how disgusting and rich these people are. Sometimes it's like a wish fulfillment fantasy, and then other times it is just a way for us to feel bad about not being rich. Are there any other ways that we see wealth depicted in movies?
I think there's a huge difference between the ways that wealth is depicted on screen in American cinema
mm-hmm.
and European cinema.
Mm.
I think Americans are more or less more comfortable with watching movies from Europe about people being rich than they are watching American movies about American wealth, because we have a societal thing about not having a class system.
Mm.
So that's very complicated. Whereas in Europe, most European countries have a history of aristocracy. And, a certain landed class and a certain peasant class. And mm-hmm. that's sort of, those roles are not current, but they exist.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in American cinema, quite often it's a rise and fall story, and very often tied to criminality.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the times when you're talking about a decadent American movie, the people being decadent are criminals
mm-hmm.
in a certain one regard or another.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about your Scarfaces, your Wolves of Wall Street, this kind of thing. It's contradictory. It's production code type thinking, where you are allowed to showcase these decadences as long as at the end a lesson is learned, someone's taken down a peg, they're caught, they lose their money, something happens. So it allows us the participatory pleasures of indulging with these people. And then, but then also, you know, status quo is restored and we get our little revenge at the end too.
Right.
It's interesting you mentioned the production code. Like, I was sort of thinking about, like, they usually talk about these escapist Depression era movies, but I was sort of thinking of the role that the Hays Code played in, well, you can't show sex, you can't show violence, so people gotta dance, and then you have, like, these really opulent displays of, like, you know, the Busby Berkeley musicals. Like, I don't know if you've seen Footlight Parade, but it's like, these almost abstract formations of people.
Yeah. But I love the idea of abstract opulence, because that hadn't occurred to me when we were talking about this topic. But that people just want to see shiny stuff on screen.
In a more meta sense, almost all of Hollywood filmmaking is a display of opulence, as opposed to most other national cinemas and American independent cinema. I mean, you know, $200 million budgets.
Yeah,
you know, that's a display of opulence. Yes. Even if it's not in the, even if that movie is about characters who are middle class, they're getting into something that is, you know, in and of itself a signal to whoever watches the movie that there's a lot of money in this.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. No, it's telling that our, as we say, those $200 million budgets, I mean, they typically are depicting wealthy people or people who are above wealth a lot of the time. It's like superheroes, right?
Right. It's the characters in the movies are quote unquote regular Joes. External forces transform them into be something other than, you know, where they came from. For example, Superman.
Right. Yeah. Though this is a total guess, but they're the Avengers saga. We have Tony Stark, who is the that was one of the first things I thought of when we talked about this topic. Is like, not only is that a really extravagant movie, the figure at the center is, it's all about ways that he can display his wealth.
Well, it's about displaying his wealth in the quote unquote right way.
Right.
The first Iron Man in the Iron Man narrative is about Tony learning the lesson that he can't be a weapons developer because that's evil. And he can't, you know, sleep with beautiful women at parties because that's bad. He has to join forces with these other, you know, heroes who may not be like Hawkeye, who lives like in Bed-Stuy, you know, in like a walk-up. That's a different type of thing, and he has to use his wealth for good. So a lot of times in American cinema, it's like, yeah, he's super rich, but he's doing the right thing, which is what Batman is.
Right. Exactly.
I thought it was funny, like, in the last Batman film, there's a whole plot point that, like, it was sort of strange about him getting his money stolen on Wall Street or something like that. Like, they made him
poor. Yeah.
It was sort of really strange taking that away, but... because that didn't really factor into the story that much.
Yeah. But, like, no, it was more of a cultural talking point.
Yeah.
Like, I think, like, Americans are typically, like, fine with characters being very wealthy. It's just, like, they have to feel like those characters either earn the wealth or, like you said, are using it well. So, like, I think in the first Batman movie, you know, he's rich, but they put a lot of effort into showing that, oh, he's not spoiled. He went and ate beats and trained with ninjas and sort of make you feel like, oh, it's okay, he's going to use his money well. Or I mean, like, a film that was really popular a couple of years ago was the Slumdog Millionaire, and right, but sorry. Like, you know, that's a film where it's like, oh, he deserves it, give him all the money.
And
I think, like, you know, we want to identify with characters and we want to see those characters be successful. And because in most arenas, success is typically measured monetarily. I think that's why we see a lot of films that are given, like the happy ending is the hero getting money almost out of nowhere.
Yeah,
it's almost like a you know, from the sky, from the gods, you know, I've bestowed you money because we like you.
Yeah. Yeah. Can you think of an American film where the main character earns his money the right way and gets to keep it at the end and gets to enjoy it and live out a happy life? Like, our narrative is always like money and wealth are isolating and it's not actually noble to pursue those things.
Well, I mean, you probably don't see that much because it's like a one-act structure. Like, the rise and fall is a great sort of
right
three-act structure that you can turn into a story. And then the inverse of that, where, you know, you start off with everything, you lose it all, and you get it all back or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, that's also sort of a great structure to tell a story, I think. Like, it's not dramatically compelling to watch a character, you know, work really, really, really hard and
yeah.
save... One of my favorite uses of money in movies is when people use money to try and buy something that, like, you can't, like, trying to buy the past. You know, you have Sunset Boulevard, it's kind of about that. Even, like, Citizen mm-hmm. Kane building a Xanadu and, like, trying to kind of recapture something from his past. Or
mm-hmm.
There's a really good documentary called Grey Gardens, which is sort of about that. Have
yes,
you seen
indeed.
It?
Or? Oh, yes, indeed. That's about decadence, like, almost. That's about decadence, like an unearned decadence,
mm-hmm.
because they live
right.
as if they still have that money. Yeah.
Yeah, they have that money, and they're trying to live, you know, like it was 50 years earlier. They're sort of living in the past, and you see everything kind of rotting, and there might not even be actually that much money left. They're sort of still living like they're wealthy, but, like, it's very obviously two people surrounded by decline, I guess. And
right.
like they're just like wealthy enough that they can afford to be eccentric.
Yeah. Yeah, they're not so much wealthy. It's kind of that old European model mm-hmm. where they have titles or standing.
Mm-hmm.
Not like a title, like they're a, you know, like a baroness or something, but they do have that Kennedy name. And
right.
the Kennedy name is a watchword for American aristocracy. There seems to be no other, maybe Rockefeller. But see, even Rockefeller has like sort of like an evil capitalist
mm-hmm.
connotation. So to be a Rockefeller is not as glamorous as to be a Kennedy.
Mm-hmm. Right. Their money seemed to come out of nowhere. It wasn't like he was an oil baron or a robber baron.
Yeah.
Like another type of story is like where you sort of see the everyday character trying to worm themselves into that American aristocracy or European aristocracy. Like I'm kind of mm-hmm. thinking
yeah,
of Talented
climber.
Mr. Mm-hmm. Ripley. Or Barry Lyndon, which is sort of like you're not really ever a part of this social class and you kind of worm your way in and you still don't quite fit in and usually they're kind mm-hmm. of ejected by the end because, like, you'll never be like them.
Yeah.
Right, yeah, because they, especially in Talented Mr. Ripley, it's like the social climber is a pathetic character, even though more or less, I mean, that is what most Americans dream about,
mm-hmm.
is to infiltrate. Or to, you know, to have, there is this like American myth of like upward mobility.
Right.
But it's taught in such a way that you have to work for it.
Well, it's like Will Smith's
Pursuit
oh,
yes.
of Happiness. Right?
Oh, that is the story.
Like,
yes.
That's kind of the example of like that's.
That is that story where you see a man work really, really hard and get to earn all his money.
But like, I don't think that's like a good movie though.
No.
It's like
no.
sort of dramatically not very interesting. And like I think like maybe its popularity is because it does kind of feed back into that like American myth of being
right.
rewarded for hard work.
We touched on this a little bit, but let's contrast that with the way that Europeans depict the wealthy in their films. I'm thinking of something like The Rules of the Game.
Yeah,
That's
kind of the ur-text.
Yeah.
in terms of a bunch of rich people out of house.
Yeah.
that sort of subgenre of European cinema that seems to just always be around.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
From The Rules of the Game, you have very variations and different iterations. More of them self-critical than that one. Some more extravagant than that one. I'm thinking of like The Exterminating Angel, which is more or less The Rules of the Game, but with surrealism.
Mm-hmm.
All the way down to films that just like came out this year. Like I'm thinking of Saint Laurent, the Yves Saint Laurent biopic, mm-hmm. more or less, but it's very much like, let's revel in the sensuous pleasures of this guy's life. Mm-hmm. It's very European.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, there's so many British films about the upper class, the wealthy, where that's not really ever commented on. It's just sort of the texture or the background of the story. Mm-hmm. You know, becomes the scene for the whole story to take place and play out in. Like, I just watched, Room with a View.
Yeah. Yeah, Room with a View.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah, okay, yeah.
Like, it's all about, like, wealthy people, but it's not about wealthy people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's an American version of that as well, right?
Well, like, the Woody Allen films you sort of mentioned. Right. Like, even in something like Blue Jasmine, where he's sort of commenting on it, it's his idea of what everyday people
yeah, is, laughable.
Seems like really out of touch. Yeah.
I think in films that are about wealth, it doesn't become a film about wealth until you contrast the characters who have wealth with ones who don't,
mm-hmm.
or on various levels, which is why all Woody Allen films are more or less pitched at the same level. I think that critique that the line on him basically is that he's out of touch, but most of these stories, to varying degrees, don't pretend that they are reflective. Right. They take place in a self-contained universe. Mm-hmm. And there are, and I think there are certain British films that are like that too, like Room with a View. Like, when you buy a Merchant Ivory film, it's like, you know what that is. Yeah. You know what the universe is going to be and what the characters are going to be like. Mm-hmm. However, if you watch a British film, like a kitchen sink film,
mm-hmm. yeah.
it's like, that's the reactionary, you know, thing to wealth.
Yeah, I like it when it sort of starts off in this ancillary world, almost like a Merchant Ivory film, and then the characters are sort of taken out of it. Like, one of my favorite films, it's by another Italian filmmaker, Bernardo Bertolucci, it's The Last Emperor.
Mm.
Or like another film that's a little bit similar is Empire of the Sun, the Steven Spielberg film with Christian Bale, you know, where he's like this little brat and you're kind of watching him put into the real world, this very wealthy child all of a sudden has nothing. And what's really amazing about that film is you're watching this person grow up over the course of the film and mature.
Mm-hmm. So, but we're talking largely about movies of the past, but in terms of contemporary cinema, I don't know, in our current economic landscape, how well a fun comedy of manners is going to go over, considering the economic disparity, especially in America, but I imagine it's become more pronounced all over the world. And even a story like Citizen Kane or Take Your Pick, where it's about how sad rich people are, I don't know how well that would go over today. I don't know if there's an appetite for that story.
Well, there certainly is at the Oscars.
Yeah, well,
I mean, that's been several movies of the past several years. Last year, Foxcatcher
mm-hmm.
was more or less about that.
Mm-hmm.
Wolf of Wall Street, like I said.
Yeah.
Spring Breakers.
Yeah.
Bling Ring.
Yeah. But that's different. Sort of, yeah.
No, I mean, they're different, but they are openly questioning wealth
mm-hmm.
and what it means to have money in relation to people who have different levels of money. Which American cinema usually is not very good at asking those questions, because it's an unspoken thing in society that we don't ask those kind of questions. So right. I think that the recession and the sort of tumultuous economy that we have now and wage gaps, it's opening up that kind of cultural space to tell these stories in a questioning way and actually say, like, you know, it's not so much that rich people are better at us or happier or they're sadder. It's that we should be making movies that have a, you know, that talk about these experiences.
Yeah, let's not pretend it doesn't exist.
Right.
That was the one thing about Wolf of Wall Street. Actually, as I was watching La Dolce Vita, that was the movie that I thought of. It has that same almost episodic structure.
And doesn't Leonardo DiCaprio ride a woman in that film?
Or somebody I want to say does. Yes.
Or does that?
I think Jonah Hill.
Or like
does.
A little person.
There's definitely. Yeah.
I feel like that's a very, like, that's taking more or less from La Dolce Vita. There's a lot of like dehumanization at these parties.
Yeah.
That goes on. That feels very, very much like of that kind of cut from the same cloth.
Precisely, yeah. And it has the same... I felt similarly exhausted after seeing that movie. And I... And, also, there were a good 10 scenes. Like, that talk about a repetitive movie. But
I love that movie. Okay, I do. Yeah. I think it's fantastic.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah. But again, that was immediately what the movie I thought of when I... It's a little JV.
Yeah, it is very nakedly about excess.
Yeah.
There is no sort of pretension about taking things maybe at a slower key. Mm-hmm. Scorsese is not interested in that at all.
No.
Which is certainly why I think it's a divisive movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we won't get into it here. It's for another podcast. But I think it's interesting, again, because The Bling Ring and... Spring Breakers, like, it, you're right, it does directly, it tackles these issues head on.
Yeah, and again, it's that element of criminality being sort of the only acceptable impetus for people gaining wealth.
Right, right. So we're kind of back to the 1930s.
Or, sorry, in the Bling Ring's case, it's like they're already wealthy, but they're not. But they're committing crimes anyway.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's she joins... The group of people that are wealthy.
Okay.
I mean, those are movies that take on issues of class directly.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. So in the 1930s, we had similar economic troubles. And so it began, like, the rise of the gangster film and the aspirational criminal film. But... What is the tenor of these of our contemporary movies about people who strive to be wealthy by any means versus films of the past?
Well, I think there's like maybe a little bit more of a tendency to demonize the very wealthy instead of seeing it as something to aspire to, like a lot of films during the Depression did. But like I do think, you know, even people with lots and lots of money are people and have human experiences and, you know, therefore have probably interesting stories worth telling. And it becomes more of a question of which stories we choose to tell ourselves at a particular moment in time. But another documentary that I think is pretty recent was Queen of Versailles, which is about this very, very wealthy American family. And they even say during the documentary, like, instead of a rags to riches story, it's a riches to rags story. And I think, like, you know, you actually can have a lot of empathy for even extremely wealthy people who are in a completely different class and sort of understand that it's its own human experience with its own difficulties. And I would sort of hope that, you know, maybe more films could have that.
Yeah.
There is another film that reminded me of what you were saying, which is I Am Love, which is an Italian film with Tilda Swinton in it. And she plays kind of a female godfather type figure of this family who is incredibly wealthy. But she's in charge of sort of maintaining their legacy and their properties and the family itself. And it's very, I think it's very compassionate and very much interested in the fact that the movie doesn't condemn her for having this money and having these problems. It treats them as real problems, and it's rooted in her character. And it's a very beautiful movie and compelling to watch. There is not this attitude of... There's not an attitude of sort of voyeurism, looking at something that's alien from us, but it really invites you into it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think that's a good example of how you can do... And it's pointedly European wealth too. Yes. So there's not that kind of social critique that you get in some, you know, movies about Europe where it's like, you know, a crumbling upper class. It's a more compassionate look at that.
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, it seems like we're getting into listing some of our favorites. So I might as well go for it. We talked about this film a few weeks ago, but I think we should, I just want to quickly mention Clueless as a film where wealth is depicted and gently, very, very gently chided or made fun of. But ultimately, the film doesn't demonize its wealthy characters. In many ways, it celebrates the lifestyle and we get, there is a certain voyeurism to watching Cher and her amazing wardrobe. Any other examples?
There's a film I really like called Boiler Room.
Oh, yes.
Giovanni Ribisi. And,
That was the film before Wolf of Wall Street. Same story.
There's a sort of a more of a focus on the moral crisis. And I like it a little bit more because of that. And it's not nearly as exhausting. Yes. That's a really good film. There's an older film I really like called The Devil and Daniel Webster, which is sort of
That's a spectacular movie.
Yeah, it's a really good movie. And that's, you know, we have a lot of stories where people get money and it's like a deal with the devil. But this one's a literal deal with the devil. Mm-hmm. So that's good.
Is that like, is it a Faustian?
It's more or less that. But it's like rural Americana,
okay,
like in the 1800s. And it's very like small scale, which mm-hmm. I think which makes it so appealing. It's like this guy just doesn't want his farm to fail.
Okay. Kristen, how about you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, just of the past several years, the Saint Laurent movie I thought was one of my favorites that I've seen this year. And it's, like La Dolce Vita, it's very interested in just sort of sensual pleasures, mm-hmm. but not interested in them theoretically. It's interested in them texturally, viscerally. It's a very just sort of, it's a whole movie about fabrics and things, as you might expect from a movie about Yves Saint Laurent. It's about textures, it's about smells, it's about, you know, people, you know, touching each other, dancing, you know, you have the sex, drugs, and rock and roll and all that stuff, but it's about the ways in which that sensual pleasures are connected to creative process and artistic process. So it really like melds those two worlds together very well. So even though it is about decadence, there is a lot of artistry in the figure of Yves Saint Laurent, and then also in the construction of the film itself.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. One more for me. We've mentioned Citizen Kane, but his second film I think also qualifies, The Magnificent Ambersons. Mm-hmm. And that's less about passing judgment on the characters for their downfall, but it sees it as more an inevitability of time passing and their inability to shift and get with the times, essentially. And it's sort of a lament about that, which is rare in American cinema. Mm-hmm. And Orson Welles was someone who had tremendous sympathy for the aristocracy. It was the middle class that he didn't have a lot of patience for. But yeah, that it's an anomaly in American cinema.
Well, I think one filmmaker you see sort of inspired by that aspect of Magnificent Ambersons is Wes Anderson with mm-hmm. stuff like Royal Tenenbaums. It's also kind of about this lament for the changing of the times. And there's also, I think, a lot of empathy for the difficulties that people in this upper crust experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so I guess I think we covered the spectrum there.
I hope people are taking notes.
Yeah.
We name checked a lot of good movies.
We did. All right. I guess we, you guys, listeners have homework to do, and so do I. And just when you thought we were done gorging ourselves, here are some final notes of positivity. Kristen, what's one thing you've seen, done, imbibed that you've been digging lately?
The work of Patti Smith.
Oh, cool. Awesome.
Yeah. She has a new book out, a second sort of quasi-memoir called M-Train, which is sort of decadent and sensuous in the ways that we are talking about. It's more just like about memories of people and things and places, and about it, very loosely structured in terms of the coffee shops that she's visited throughout her life and how that triggers reminiscences in her. And this earlier this year I read Just Kids for the first time, so when I heard that she had another book out, I was like, I'm on it.
Yes.
It's also like, I think it's also like, it's like the 40th anniversary of Horses, her album too, and she's like touring with that. So I've just been digging Patti Smith. Like, in general, it's a good time to be Patti Smith, and it's a good time for me personally to fall in love with her creative works.
It's never a bad time.
Nope.
No. Martin, how about you?
I guess this time it's a short film by Todd Haynes called Dotty Gets Spanked.
Oh.
I think he made it before Safe, and it's only about half an hour, I think. And it's very funny, but also sort of poignant, and he kind of creates this story. It feels a little bit like an after-school special, but there's, yeah, of course, because it's Todd Haynes' real emotion that comes out through it, and it's, I guess it's about a boy who's developing an interest in spanking.
Oh.
But, and he's got these dreams about it where it's like modeled on like German expressionist films where he's saying, you know, spank, I won't, you know, you must be spanked by the strongest man in the kingdom.
Wow.
This, like, giant like turn of the century weightlifter guy comes out and spanks this like I Love Lucy type character that he's obsessed with on television. It's very outrageous, but I think anyone who's interested in Todd Haynes should see this short film.
I absolutely must see the short film immediately.
That sounds amazing.
Yes. Is this pre Superstar?
It's
no, that's someone else.
No, that's him.
Is that him?
Karen Carpenter,
yeah.
Story. Yeah, that's him. It's I think it's after the Karen Carpenter story. It's between Poison and Safe. I think
okay.
It's when he made it.
Okay. I'm going to. Is this on YouTube? Because I need to see this.
I'm pretty sure it's on YouTube.
Perfect. Okay. Excellent.
I'm making a note right now.
All right. That is excellent, Martin. Thank you. I just watched a new CW show called My Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, and I really like it. It stars Rachel Bloom as a woman who has a high-stress job at a law firm in New York and seemingly out of nowhere decides to move to West Covina, the greatest city in the whole world, and her ex-boyfriend just so happens to live there, her middle school ex-boyfriend, no less. And yeah, that's basically what it's about, and it's also a musical. I know, I understand that some people don't like musicals. I can't imagine why. But if you do like musicals, I strongly suggest you check it out if you haven't already. But what really is my final note of positivity is that with Rachel Bloom and Lady Gaga taking over on American Horror Story, I am just so thrilled to see that the theater nerds have taken over our media landscape. Like that fills me with delight, I have to say. Like I know it's not for everybody, but it is for me. It makes me happy. They're so earnest. And that's the way we frame it, FlixWise, that is. Listeners, what are some of your favorite cinematic visions of excess? Come let us know on our website, flixwise.com. Or you can like us and leave us a comment on Facebook at facebook.com/flixwise. And if you want to come hang out with me on Twitter, the handle is @flixwise. And the only thing I ask in return is that you rate us and leave us a nice comment on iTunes. It really helps us stand out in the database. On our next show, we may or may not do Paolo Sorrentino's 2013 film, The Great Beauty, as a FlixWise favorites entry. And it's also a pretty good companion piece to La Dolce Vita, so we'll see if we can make that happen. But if not, then our next episode is actually going to be a Christmas episode. Christmas theme episode. But either way, it should be fun. Anyway, Kristen, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me again.
Martin, pleasure as always.
Pleasure as always. Ciao.
Ciao. Indeed. All right. Okay, we've got private islands to hop and parties to crash, but until next time, ta-ta. Ciao, Bella. I like it. How many ways can we say, how many fancy ways are there to say goodbye?
Ciao.
Ciao. Ciao, ciao.
Yeah.